This is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
This is the top job in a city that right now is dealing with multiple crises.
One of America's greatest inventions, the urban political machine.
I know you've heard of the term kingmaker, queenmaker.
This is a system where the politicians are picking the voters. The voters aren't picking the politicians. As Democrats and Republicans both play this game.
Can you quantify how much it costs to corrupt a congressman?
Some on the left sheepishly have asked if the conservative movement is dead. To them, I say, absolutely not.
We know that this system is dying out. This machine is dying out. They're on the last legs.
This is no longer a question of partisanship. It is not a question of which party is electing their leaders. It's a question of citizenship. Who has the right to be heard in our nation?
Welcome to the show. I'm Arun Venugopal. Kai's out this week. After over a year of suffering through lockdowns, job losses, and the deaths of thousands of our friends, our neighbors, and our loved ones, New Yorkers finally seem to be emerging from the pandemic. It's a little strange, a little surreal, but having been to an actual movie in an actual movie theater, an actual live play, and a panel discussion on a rooftop downtown, not to mention a few restaurants, I have personally felt the hot, unmasked breath of the city upon my face, and I kind of like it. The real action this week, however, is in the political realm. New Yorkers are in the process of deciding who will succeed Mayor Bill de Blasio, arguably the tallest mayor we've had, and they'll also be voting on dozens of candidates for city council, borough president, controller, public advocate. It's a highly consequential few days. Joining me to discuss is Bridget Bergen, our colleague in the WNYC newsroom who reports on City Hall and politics across the city. Hi, Bridget.
Hey, Arun.
So, Bridget, every election cycle, there is all this overheated rhetoric about it being the most consequential, the most important election in the history of the city and the history of all cities and suburbs and subdivisions and municipalities ever and so on. Tell us, what is really at stake here this time around?
Okay, Arun. So it is hugely consequential.
Okay, all right.
You know, the previous three mayors have served multiple terms, right? So barring some monumental change in the electorate, it is very likely that whoever wins will be in place not just for 4 years, but likely for 8 years. So that's two terms, not just one. And we're at a point when the city has real fiscal troubles. Like, yes, we received a massive federal bailout that's supposed to help us get back on our feet, but some of those funds are being used to pay for programs that people are going to have expectations around. They're going to expect they will last after those funds dry up. The next mayor is going to need to decide what they're going to pay for. And as a nation, we continue to face really existential threats, whether we're talking climate change or the reform movement around police and the reckoning over race. You know, those are very real issues here in New York City. We also have local issues, affordable housing crisis, a real spike in shootings, questions about the sustainability of our infrastructure. A new mayor inherits all of that. So the decisions that voters are making in the coming days and have been making, you know, over the past 9 days, we've just wrapped up early voting a few minutes ago, just about an hour ago. They're hugely consequential.
Bridget, one thing we do know about voter turnout in these local elections in the city is that it's historically really low. I am wondering, why is that? I mean, is it the slate of candidates we have on the ballot? There's a lot of ambivalence, I think, about this group of candidates, or is it the way we do elections?
I think it's a combination of things, Arun. First of all, as you said, we do tend to see a real significant drop off in our local elections, but, you know, particularly because they are timed to, you know, be separate from our presidential election where we have the highest turnout. So some of this in part, you know, is arguably by design. The scheduling of these elections are, you know, at a time when people are paying less attention to what is happening. And, you know, these elections, while, you know, in these last few days, voters may feel like they're being bombarded with coverage, whether it's on, you know, on in media or, you know, if their mailbox is overflowing or their phone is blowing up with text messages, that hasn't been happening in the same way as, you know, what we saw during the 2020 presidential election cycle. That's one piece of it. The other part of it is we have a closed primary system in New York State, which means that if you are a registered voter, You can only participate in this big event if you are a registered voter of a party that has a primary. And so we spend a lot of time right now talking about the Democratic Party and the Democratic primary because it is the most crowded, and Democrats mm-hmm. outnumber Republicans in New York by about 7-1. But the largest share of new voters, new registered voters, are actually what we define as blanks in New York State, unaffiliated voters. Those voters, you know, whether they were people who were inspired by Bernie Sanders and, you know, became registered voters and then found out either in 2016 that they couldn't vote in the Democratic primary or in subsequent elections, people who have been activated and wanted to join the process but maybe had questions about the party system, those people will not be able to participate in this election that the official primary is Tuesday.
So early voting wrapped up, what, in the last hour or so,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, just closed. Polls just closed. It's so exciting.
It is pretty exciting, isn't it? I mean, do we have any idea of what that's looked like, if it's been robust or, you know, who's been showing up, or is it too early?
Well, so this is the thing. We have never had early voting for a municipal primary of this scale. We've only had early voting since 2019. It was passed when the Democrats took control of the state Senate. It's something that was routinely passed in the assembly, but it was not made into law until the Senate Democrats took control. And then it was enacted. The first election with early voting was actually the general election in 2019, where we voters passed ranked choice voting as one of the ballot referendums. But it was a relatively low turnout election. And then since then, obviously, in 2020, we had a primary election and a general election. But those were also very strange elections because they were elections going on during a pandemic. And so during the early voting period in the spring of 2020, we had very low turnout during early voting because we had massive turnout from absentee ballots because people were staying in their homes and they were voting by mail. Then we had larger turnout during early voting in November. We saw those huge lines. That in part is also because that was an election that was open to anyone who was registered, that was not confined to just people who were voting in a primary. So what we do know so far is that about 191,000 New Yorkers turned out for early voting. Now, that's out of about 3.7 Democrats and another 500,000 or so Republicans. So we're talking about less than 5% of the eligible electorate turning out for early voting at this point. But we, even in the times that we've had early voting in place, the highest turnout has still been on Election Day. What we hope to know more about, and what some campaigns seem to know more about, is who these people are that actually voted. The Board of Elections says that they will make that data available to people who request it. Some campaigns have requested it. Certainly we at WNYC and Gothamist have requested it. And so hopefully before Tuesday, we'll be able to talk a little bit more about who these actual voters are, where they are in the city. At this point, we just have very raw numbers that the Board of Elections has made available on their website by borough. You know, turnout has been larger in Manhattan and Brooklyn. That's not hugely surprising. What could be really interesting is to know where in Manhattan and Brooklyn the turnout has been very high. So hopefully we'll have more to say about that very soon.
Bridget, you mentioned, I guess, the challenge of people who are, you know, wanting to participate who are not Democrats or Republicans. There is a growing contingent of voters, correct, who are unaffiliated with any party. Am I right?
Absolutely. It's one of the largest growing shares of the electorate.
And do we understand why that's the case?
You know, I think that when new voters are registered, you know, you have the idea of having to make a choice about joining a party is a very personal one. And in New York, we kind of add another layer of complication because it becomes difficult, I think, for voters to decide if they want to align themselves with a party. But if you don't, you kind of are left out of the ability of making some of the most consequential decisions because there is a fair assumption coming out of this primary that the Democratic nominees will, in most districts across the city and certainly citywide, have a huge leg up when it comes to the general election.
And we have a caller we're going to go to now. This is Derek in Brooklyn. Derek, are you there?
Hi. Yes, I'm here.
Hi.
So tell us, how
do you feel about the process of the candidates and this whole thing that we're going through?
Well, right now, I have to tell you, I feel completely overwhelmed. I've talked to other people myself and in my community. I live in Bed-Stuy, and other people have told me the same thing. It's very, you know, it's not just you're just one person. You have to vote for mayor. You've got mayor. You've got controller. Got people running for city council, and it's very overwhelming. And you hope that you're going to make a decision that is on point and it's consequential, but you know, it's just completely overwhelming. You know,
I hear you. Thank you, Derek. Bridget, this is something that was echoed by a close friend of mine today who's actually works for the city, and they live in Sunnyside, and they said they were overwhelmed by the choice. They don't even know who to pick for council member, something which is fairly high profile. Is this something you're picking up on?
Yeah, I mean, one of the effects of we have a new voting system that we are using in this city for this election, ranked choice voting. And it gives voters the opportunity or, you know, depending on how they're feeling, the burden of potentially not just choosing one, but they have the opportunity, they're not required, to select up to five candidates in order of preference. It's, you know, filling out the ballot itself, the actual process of filling out is not overly complicated, but you know, voters who really take their civic duty seriously and really want to research their candidates and make sure that they understand who they are choosing and why, which, you know, presumably everyone does, but realistically, that's probably not always the case. It's more work potentially. And so particularly in these races that maybe don't get the same amount of attention and coverage as something like the mayor's race, which has gotten the lion's share of coverage during this cycle. People can use ranked choice voting at the top of their ticket for the mayor's race, the controller's race, public advocate, city council, borough president. You know, if you're choosing five candidates for those five races and you've come up with, you know, five ranks for all of them, 25 candidates that you're thinking about going into to vote. You know, a lot of people that I've spoken to, I've talked to a lot of voters coming out of voting. They brought in a copy of their voter guide because you can bring something in with you to assist. Some people made lists, like a little note card that they could refer to because, you know, it's a big ballot to fill out. So if there's a way to make it a little easier on yourself, you are entitled to do that. And if that helps, then great.
Then do our homework. Yeah. All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be taking more of your calls. Again, call us at 646-435-7280. And I'll be asking Bridget more about the history of our election system and how that history continues to reverberate today. Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Arun Vanigopal, and this week we're talking about the state of democracy in the U.S. and in particular in New York. I'm here with Bridget Bergen, the City Hall and politics reporter here at WNYC and Gothamist. We're talking about the elections in New York, and in this segment, we're specifically turning to the history of how we got the election system we have today. How does that history reverberate today? Bridget, let's turn to the history and talk a little more about how we got the election system that we have today. We're going back to the 19th century, really. I mean, that's when we saw the system that we're kind of inherited kind of took shape, correct?
Yeah, I mean, our election law that really guides the elections that, you know, we administer to this day, it really goes back to the 1890s. And it was at a time when, you know, the two-party system really became written into the fabric of our election law. And it's part of why we see, you know, a board of elections that is this agency that kind of acts in a way that, you know, is funded by the city, has some oversight by the state, but is really in large part controlled by the parties. And it is built into the administration of our elections that everything must be done with one Democrat, one Republican, a bipartisan system. But that can raise some other challenges and some real questions for people who are not part of those parties.
Now, one legacy of the system is that some voters can be left out of the process, right? I mean, in your reporting on early voting, you say you ran into voters who'd always participate in local elections, but because they weren't registered with the Democratic Party this year, they weren't able to cast a ballot. Tell us a little about those voters and what you heard from them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I went out on the first morning of early voting. We wanted to see who was there, what were the issues that were bringing them out? What did they care about in this election? And I talked to a man named Cornelius Jacobs in Far Rockaway. He was voting at the Rockaway YMCA. And he was really frustrated. He wanted to support Maya Wiley. He believed in her platform. He had spent, you know, the better part of the morning going to different early voting sites, trying to find his site. And when he ended up at the YMCA in Far Rockaway, he ultimately wasn't able to vote.
And why don't we listen to Cornelius Jacobs from Far Rockaway now?
I came here to vote, and I found out that since I'm with the Green Party, I'm not entitled to vote today. I have to wait for the general election.
And you said to me before, you never missed an election.
I have never missed an election. I voted when I was in Vietnam in 1968.
Hmm. And so what's changed, Bridget? I mean, like, this is why can't you vote anymore?
Well, so I think that's one of the confusing things about some of our elections. You know, whether he has voted in every primary since 1968, you know, I didn't look up Mr. Jacobs' voting record, but, you know, I think that is one of the things that with our closed primary system, there is no primary for the Green Party. And so he is not eligible to vote in this particular primary. And obviously that can be a frustration. That's something that here you have someone who's really engaged. And, you know, not only do we have a closed primary system in New York, but we also have one of the earliest dates for when, if he were to want to change his party affiliation, so he could have participated in this primary, he would have needed to have done it in February. And that, Arun, is an improvement on what it used to be, because it used to be that you had to do it back in October before the last general election. So, you know, it used to be even worse than that. The legislature's improved it slightly. But still, there are some places where you could, you know, change your party affiliation closer to the primary. And given how much attention, the fact that voters don't start tuning in until later, you know, there could be a real question about maybe it should be even closer to the primary date.
Here's a question from a listener: who benefits from low voter turnout?
Well, I think most people would say the people who benefit are the people who are driving that turnout, and usually the people driving that turnout are the people who are already in power. If you are, the harder you make it to vote, and we know that people are more likely to vote if they have been spoken to directly, and if you are only speaking to a certain base, then, you know, potentially you have more control over the outcome of that election if only it's your voters who are turning out.
Bridget, you mentioned earlier on just how overwhelming a lock, I guess, the Democratic Party has on New York City voters. I think you said 7-to-1 ratio versus Republicans in the city. But what about other parties like the Working Families Party, which we've seen emerge to some extent in recent years, correct?
Sure. I mean, the Working Families Party plays a really important role in terms of, I think, defining the agenda and oftentimes pushing the Democratic Party. But the Working Families Party kind of has to fight for its survival on a routine basis. You know, most recently, there was a change made. Governor Cuomo has kind of been an adversary with the Working Families Party, even though they have endorsed him in the past. That relationship is extremely fraught. And the power dynamic there is part of the reason they at one point had, you know, threatened to withhold an endorsement. And then so ultimately in, you know, a budget cycle in, I think it was 2020. I don't have the number date right in front of me. Mm-hmm. There was language put into the budget that increased the number of votes that the Working Families Party needed to secure to maintain its ballot line. It used to be about 50,000 votes, and then it bumped up about three times that. And that became a real, it was an existential threat, because by having a ballot line that gives the party some power, if they were to want to challenge, say, you know, if they didn't agree with the Democratic nominee in a certain office, then they theoretically could put up an opposing candidate on the Working Families Party line. Some candidates have run initially and exclusively on the Working Families Party line. It's where current Attorney General Letitia James got her start. She ran initially as a city council candidate on the Working Families Party line. Hmm. And so it can be a real tool, but it is something that would have been diminished had they lost their ballot line. They had to fight for it, and they fought successfully. They kind of beat back that challenge. What they needed people to do was to vote for the presidential candidates, in this case, the Democratic presidential candidates, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, on the Working Families Party line to maintain that line. And they were able to do that successfully and secure enough votes and maintain that line. But it is one of those, as an organizing tool and as a way to push a progressive agenda, you know, the party tends to not want to introduce candidates as spoilers. They tend to really want to just push the agenda. And, you know, they played a role in this mayor's race as well. They were out in front initially making a ranked choice endorsement. But, you know, this has been a very strange and chaotic mayoral primary. And their initial endorsement has changed. They had initially endorsed Scott Stringer, Diane Morales, and Maya Wiley. And now really Maya Wiley is the only candidate that they are standing behind.
We have another caller on the line here. David from Howard Beach, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you for taking my call. I'll try to be coherent and quick. Filling out and trying to research my mail-in ballot felt like doing not just a term paper, but a master's degree. And listening to your conversation, I got the same feeling that I had once I found out what school decentralization was about. That's where in the name of community control and community input, they changed the entire way the city system was worked. And in the name of giving power to the people who actually used the public schools, what happened was they politicized the entire school system. And as you just said before, those groups that were already politically well organized came in like vultures and took over the school system. And it's taken us years to even begin to recover from that. This ranked choice voting, if you're going to do it right, you ask each candidate 10 questions. They write their answers. You publish that in a document, and then I can compare and see what they're doing. But the way this is done, it's just made to confuse and made for the people who already have power to have an even stronger grasp on power. That's my statement.
Thanks so much, David. Bridget, a sort of disillusioned voter responding to these changes. Any thoughts to add there?
Well, I would say, David, let's give it a shot. We haven't had a whole citywide primary with ranked choice voting yet. So let's maybe see how it turns out. But I do think he is also giving voice to some of the concerns, certainly, that I have heard from voters and from, you know, other elected officials and advocates around ranked choice voting. It is a new system. It required voter education, which, you know, depending on who you ask, it's either you can't go anywhere or go to any media without seeing something about ranked choice voting, or you still don't understand what it is. To his larger point about, can a system be manipulated by people with power to, you know, maintain their power? I think that is always a concern with elections, particularly if there is unequal access to information about how that system is operating. And that's one of the things that we will be watching closely in the coming days. We know that because not just of ranked choice voting, but because of some of the changes that have been made to our election laws to prevent voter disenfranchisement, that it's going to take longer to get the final results of this election. And that's going to be different for everyone. That's going to be different for candidates, for voters, for the media. And I think it's going to be hard. What we know at this point is that on Tuesday night, when the polls close at 9 p.m., shortly thereafter, we will get the first batch of unofficial election night returns that they will not be put through the ranked choice tally system. We know that after that point, according to the Board of Elections, they will not do their first official tally of ranked choice votes until a week later. That is something, how people respond to that, what people do with that information, knowing that it's incomplete, knowing that it will not yet include absentee ballots and affidavit ballots, that those ballots could still be coming in and still be completely eligible and worthy of being counted, is an open question. Ultimately, the Board of Elections has said that their final result could take until the week of July 12th. Because that's when all the eligible ballots should be in. But that's a long time. And that's not because of ranked choice voting. But I think there are a lot of people who it will be hard to separate this new system from everything that comes afterwards.
Bridget, we only have a couple minutes left, but I want to turn to something that you have followed closely for the last few years, and perhaps the most spectacular example of a challenge to machine politics, which would be the events of 2018, when then Congressman Joseph Crowley, the fourth most powerful Democrat in the U.S. Congress, lost to this underdog, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, someone you had followed even before this spectacular win. What did that turn of events, tell us about machine politics in Queens? Has it changed significantly? Can you really say with 2 or 3 years of hindsight that something has shifted, or is it just a new face to the machine?
So there certainly is a new face to the machine. There's a new leader. Congressman Greg Meeks is now the head of the Queens County Democrats. You know, that is significant in its own right. He is a representative of Southeast Queens, which is a largely Black middle class part of the borough. So the organization has changed in some ways, but some of those same players who were, you know, aiding the organization then, some of the lawyers who, you know, worked on ballots and, you know, helped sort of run the party are still very much involved. You know, I think one of the things that's interesting when we talk about party machines, there's the traditional idea of the machine, which is the actual structure of the organization and what it's able to do. And then there's, if you think really in a more redefined way, it's the insiders, the people who have power and understand how the levers of power work, and those who are outside of the machine. And while the county party leaders, the party bosses are not necessarily playing a strong role in this current mayoral cycle, there are people who are close to them, oftentimes lawyers, who have very significant roles, who still do, you know, are able to get more information than other people, who know what it takes to get on a ballot or to kick someone else off a ballot or to kick someone out of a poll site. And those types of that knowledge of the inner workings of the system, I think that is kind of the new machine. It's sort of the insider versus the outsider.
Yeah, yeah. All right, we will have to leave it there. Bridget, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Arun.
Coming up, we're going to zoom out from the local to the national. Voting rights reporter for Mother Jones Magazine, Ari Berman, will join me to talk about all those voting rights restrictions bills that have been passed all across the country since the 2020 election. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Carolyn Adams, a producer for the United States of Anxiety. You may have become familiar with Juneteenth over this past year as conversations about systemic racism and police brutality exploded across the country. The now federal holiday marks the day when news of freedom reached the last known enslaved people in the United States in 1865. That's 2 years after President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. Juneteenth is about the resilience and legacy of a people. And in this week's show notes, we invite you to celebrate with us by listening to our special holiday episode, Juneteenth and Unfinished Business. You'll learn about the history of the holiday, hear some family stories, and listen to the sounds of freedom with WQXR's Terrence McKnight. And whether you're new to the holiday or it's been a long-held family tradition for you, there's something in it for everyone. So take a listen and let us know what you think on Twitter using the hashtag USofAnxiety or by emailing us at anxiety@wnyc.org.
Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Arun Vanigopal. We've been diving into the state of democracy in New York. Now we're going to examine the situation nationally, where there is a widespread assault on voting rights by Republicans. I'm joined by Ari Berman, who covers voting rights as a senior reporter for Mother Jones. He's also the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Hi, Ari.
Hey, Arun. Thank you for having me.
Your book was published in 2015, just a year before Trump came into office. How has the voting rights landscape changed since that book was published? And this is well before the so-called big lie that Trump is, and his followers are pushing.
It was, and things have changed quite a bit since then. My book, Give Us the Ballot, was published in 2015 on the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. And this was 2 years after the Supreme Court had gutted a key part of the Voting Rights Act, which really began to open the floodgates to new voter suppression efforts in places like Texas, North Carolina, Georgia, with a history of discrimination. So voter suppression was ongoing when I started writing my book, but it obviously intensified significantly in 2020 with Donald Trump's attempt to try to overturn an election, and then all of these Republican-controlled states trying to restrict voting access in response to that big lie. So voter suppression is not a new thing, but I would say it's significantly accelerated because of Donald Trump and his grip on the Republican Party.
And you mentioned the states that have historically had voter suppression enacted. Has it also leapt into states that have not had those problems but are now taking to it?
Yes. What I would say is that traditionally Southern methods of voter suppression have spread to the North. So it's still true that places like Georgia and Texas, they have been repeat violators of voting rights in the past, and they are violators of voting rights today. But it's also true that places like Wisconsin and Michigan, which don't have the same kind of history as a place like Georgia, they are also trying to restrict voting rights and have enacted new restrictions on voting in the past decade. So it used to be that voter suppression was more of a regional issue. Now I would say it's more of a national issue and more of a partisan issue than it used to be in the past.
Much of the work of crafting voter suppression laws comes from a group called Heritage Action. What is Heritage Action?
Heritage Action is the sister organization of the Heritage Foundation, which is one of the top think tanks in Washington, supplied much of the policies for Republican administrations like Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump. And Heritage Action is basically the political arm of the Heritage Foundation.
And Tell us how voting restrictions work. I mean, is it different depending on the state?
Yeah, so we reported in Mother Jones on this video, this leaked video that we obtained from Heritage Action, where they talked about how they were leading this effort to restrict voting rights across the country and how they had written what they called model legislation, making it harder to vote in places like Georgia and Texas and Iowa. And basically what they said is that they were working with state legislators in all of these states to pass very similar pieces of legislation. And that was a question I had when all of these states began rushing to restrict voting at the beginning of this year. I was thinking there must be someone behind this because there's no way that all of these states are passing new restrictions on voting in such a short period of time and passing such similar pieces of legislation. And basically what Heritage did is they had what they call these lists of best practices to restrict voting, making it harder to vote by mail, cutting back on the amount of time that people have to vote, adding new ID requirements, expanding access for partisan poll watchers. And this lined up almost perfectly with Donald Trump's grievances about the election. And so they basically went, you know, state by state by state and sold these conservative legislators on legislation to restrict voting rights. And it was portrayed as this organic from the bottom up thing that was happening in the states, when in fact it was this big influential conservative organization in Washington that was essentially exporting a voter suppression agenda to the states, not the other way around.
Jessica Anderson is Heritage Action's executive director, and she laid out the group's approach in that leaked video that you mentioned, which was obtained by Documented and shared with Mother Jones. Let's listen to a clip of her for a second.
Iowa was the first state that we got to work in, and we did it quickly and we did it quietly. Honestly, nobody noticed. So we worked quietly with the Iowa State Legislature. We got the best practices to them. We helped draft the bills. We made sure activists were calling the state legislators, getting support, showing up at their public hearings, giving testimony, and we were able to get three provisions in the larger election integrity bill that were directly written by the Heritage recommendation.
Ari, when I hear this and I think she doesn't really sound like she cares if this video is leaked or not. There's a good deal of confidence in how she's addressing this crowd, isn't there?
There is, but of course we wouldn't have known this if the video hadn't been leaked because this was behind the closed doors effort. They were talking to their largest donors, and one of the problems here is that they are a dark money group, and so their donors are secret. So we know they were talking to these secret donors, but we don't actually know who the donors are. They have disclosed very little of their funding. This group, Heritage Action, raised $11 million in their last annual report. They disclosed very little of that. The Heritage Foundation, which is much bigger, they raised almost $123 million in their last annual report, which is a lot of money, and disclosed very few of their donors. And so you basically have a group that is very well funded, but doesn't have to disclose its donors, essentially bragging behind closed doors about how easy it was for them to persuade Republicans to make it harder to vote. And I just think that's really disturbing to a lot of people, that you have these essentially twin threats to democracy, too much money in the system and efforts to restrict voting rights. And they're essentially working hand in hand to limit the power of everyday citizens over their democracy.
You mentioned how easy they found it. We actually do have a clip. Why don't we go ahead and play her again? This is Jessica Anderson, the executive director of Heritage Action, speaking.
My team looked at each other and were like, it can't be that easy. Like, it can't be that easy.
They're really having fun, aren't they, Ari? I mean, I guess the question really is, why is it so easy?
Well, they have the power. I mean, Republicans have majorities in places like Iowa, in places like Georgia, in places like Texas. They have done very well at the state level in the last decade. They have also been in charge of drawing the redistricting maps in those states, which has allowed them to entrench their power. What is different this year than in years past is, in years past, we saw efforts to make it harder to vote, but they're so much more coordinated now, and they're so much more sweeping than they were before, that it may have been that a state passed, for example, a new voter ID law, or a state cut back on early voting. voting, or a state made it easier to remove voters from the rolls. But now it's happening all in one bill, that instead of having one provision that makes it harder to vote, there's 17, 18, 19 provisions in these bills making it harder to vote. I mean, Heritage is bragging. They wrote 3 provisions of the Iowa law, 8 provisions of the Georgia law, 19 provisions of the Texas law. I mean, that's a dramatic escalation of efforts to make it harder to vote, coming on the heels of an attempt to try to overturn the election. And they seem gleeful about it. And we're talking about undermining the most fundamental right in democracy. And I don't think that's something that you should brag about or be gleeful about. And so I think when we release this story, obviously the coordinated effort of it disturbed a lot of people, but just the way they were speaking about restricting voting rights also disturbed a lot of people, because they're thinking, why would that be something that you would actually be proud of?
And a few days after you first published this story, you wrote that Heritage faced an ethics investigation, correct? What became of that?
Yeah, they're actually under an ethics investigation in Iowa, and another ethics investigation has been filed in Texas. And the interesting thing is that Iowa Republicans were actually very mad at Heritage for taking credit for writing parts of their voter suppression bill. And Iowa Republicans basically said Heritage didn't write this bill, and if they did lobby for it, they didn't register as lobbyists, which is against the law. And so the top Democrat in the Iowa House filed ethics complaints against Heritage Action and Heritage Foundation. And an official watchdog group in Iowa that's affiliated with the state, they have begun their own investigation. And so they either did this behind closed doors in a way that didn't comply with the law, or they may in fact, in some cases, be overstating their role. But either way, the fact that they were so open about bragging about writing these laws has angered a lot of people, including, it turns out, quite a few Republicans.
And certainly these laws are going to court. Do you have any sense of, I mean, definitely different states, but how they'll stand up to scrutiny in the court?
Well, we have a judiciary that is dominated by conservative judges. Donald Trump made 234 appointments to the federal judiciary, including 3 Supreme Court judges. So I am expecting the courts to be largely sympathetic to these efforts, which is why there's been such a push to pass federal legislation protecting the right to vote, because even a lot of Democrats and progressives are not very optimistic about how the courts might deal with these laws. They think they're going to be largely, if not entirely, supportive of these efforts, because they don't really think there's anything wrong with restricting voting rights. The courts didn't go along with Trump's attempts to try to overturn the election, but they have in the past decade been largely supportive of Republican efforts to make it more difficult to vote.
Do you sense that Republicans are still maintaining the veneer or this pretense, the myth of voter fraud, or is it becoming increasingly explicit that this is a highly racialized, campaign to disenfranchise Black voters?
I think they've become more explicit about it. There's no doubt about it. When Donald Trump talked during 2020 about trying to throw out votes from cities like Detroit and Milwaukee and Atlanta, it was very clear that he was talking about Black voters and communities of color in these kind of places. Those were the votes they were trying to throw out. And it's interesting because the issue of voter fraud was litigated so extensively in 2020. We had 60 courts, both Republican and Democratic appointed judges, that looked at this issue and concluded there was no fraud. So they've really shifted from this argument about voter fraud to this argument about election integrity. And they're basically saying, well, even if there was no fraud, people have concerns about the system, so therefore we need to change the laws, without acknowledging that people have concerns about the system because their own politicians lied to them about what happened in 2020. So if Republicans had been honest with their own voters about what happened in 2020, there would not have been this clamor to pass these kind of laws, so that they manufactured a crisis. And in response to the crisis they've manufactured, they've put forward solutions to solve a problem that doesn't really exist.
Has Heritage taken a public stand on H.R. 1, otherwise known as the For the People Act?
Yeah, Heritage has been leading the effort to block H.R. 1, the For the People Act. They've spent a lot of money against it. They've distributed talking points to Republicans on Capitol Hill about it. They even held a rally in West Virginia to pressure Joe Manchin not to support the bill and to keep the filibuster. And basically what the group's executive director, Jessica Anderson, says was that if we pass this, we lose our democracy. So they've talked about this bill in very, very explicit terms, and they really have a two-tiered strategy. One is to implement all of these new voting restrictions on the state level, and the second part of it is to block federal legislation, the For the People Act, that would preempt many of these state efforts to make it harder to vote.
So both Democrats and Republicans, or at least groups like Heritage, conservative group like Heritage, argue that basically democracy is on the line here. When we're talking about groups like Heritage, what is their idea of democracy that they see as being threatened by things like this? Is it that the specter of voting fraud, which has not been corroborated, or is it something more, built out than that?
Well, Heritage has been pushing the lie that there's widespread voter fraud in the system well before Donald Trump was. So in many ways, they originated the big lie before Donald Trump. They were talking about these issues for decades. And so I do think they have this belief that if you make voting easier, people will cheat and corrupt the system, which is just not true. But I think there's this, on this deeper level, there's this notion that Republicans, that elections are only legitimate when Republicans win them. And I think that's a very, very dangerous thing in a democracy, because one of the core tenets of a democracy is that you respect the integrity of the election no matter who wins. That's what free and fair elections are all about. When you start saying the election is only legitimate when our side wins the election, you start creeping from democracy into authoritarianism. And that's what's so dangerous about what Donald Trump did in 2020. And that's what's so dangerous about the fact that so many Republicans seemed to go along with that and are now trying to change election laws to achieve that kind of outcome.
It's not just Republicans who are opposed to H.R. 1 or the For the People Act. It's also the Democrat that I guess all eyes have been on, Joe Manchin, correct?
Correct. He opposes the For the People Act as written. He has introduced a compromise proposal that would preserve large chunks of the For the People Act, things like automatic voter registration and 2 weeks of early voting and a ban on partisan gerrymandering. And then he has also endorsed some restrictions that Republicans like new voter ID laws, although not quite as strict as the ones that Republicans want. And Democrats are largely okay with the Manchin proposal. They're not thrilled with it, but they'd be a lot happier with passing the Manchin proposal than passing no voting rights legislation. But of course, that's not going to get 60 votes either. So no bill introduced by Joe Manchin is going to get their votes required to overcome a Republican filibuster and achieve 60 votes. So then the question is, this week when Republicans block the For the People Act, what is Joe Manchin's fallback plan? Because he has said that he will not support ending the filibuster, but none of the voting rights bills that he supports, whether it's his own compromise to the For the People Act, whether it's another bill, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act that would restore key parts of the Voting Rights Act, none of them have a chance of passing without getting rid of the filibuster, without lowering the threshold of the filibuster. So that's the next debate to come once the For the People Act is blocked this week.
What kind of alarm are you sensing amongst voting rights groups? Is it pretty much sort of apocalyptic? Because at least on the ground, a lot of people don't see where things go forward from here. There seems to be a complete, I guess, standstill.
Yeah, the alarm is basically at code red right now, because the feeling is if Congress doesn't pass federal legislation protecting voting rights, there's going to be no other way to stop it. That the courts are going to be largely supportive of these efforts, and that in 2 years, there might be very different majorities in Congress. Republicans might have taken back the House or the Senate, and Democrats will lose their best chance in a generation to try to protect the right to vote. So that's why people are so alarmed right now. This is why it's such an important moment in history.
Thank you, Ari Berman, voting rights reporter for Mother Jones Magazine. You can read Ari's coverage of what's happening across the U.S. at motherjones.com. This is the United States of Anxiety. You can keep in touch by email at anxiety@wnyc.org. You can catch up on all of our shows and hear some stuff that doesn't make it into the Sunday show by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts, or you can simply go to wnyc.org/anxiety. I'm Arun Vanagopal, and it was my pleasure to guest host this week. Next week, my colleague Verilyn Williams will be in the host seat. Thanks for spending time with us. The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Hannes Brown mixed the podcast version. Kevin Bristow and Matthew Morando were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Carl Boisrond, Emily Botine, Karen Frillman, and Christopher Wirth. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Vera Lynn Williams is our executive producer, and I'm Arun Vanigopal. I hope you'll join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening and take care of yourselves.